So, Miles, all of this techno-organic tomfoolery has me thinking about Ship.
What, like Warlock and Doug?
No, not shipping. Ship. You know, proper noun, Apocalypse's former digs. OG X-Factor's friendly sentient headquarters? Cable's buddy professor.
I've been wondering about that, actually. I know Ship got sent to the future with Cable, but doesn't that mean it should have been around during the adventures of Cyclops and Phoenix?
Well, yes and no. Ship did come to the future with Cable, but for years everyone assumed it had been destroyed or lost in transit.
So how did they reunite?
Well, they didn't exactly reunite.
But Ship is definitely Professor, right? Cable's AI buddy.
Oh, absolutely. But they didn't reunite because they were never actually separated. In fact, you could say that that particular friendship was inside Cable all along.
So he just had to believe?
What? No, Ship was literally embedded in his chest.
What?!
I'm Jay Edidin.
And I'm Miles Stokes.
And we are here to explain the X-Men.
Because it's about time someone did.
Welcome to episode 272 of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, where we walk you through the ins, the outs, and the retcons of comics' greatest superhero soap opera.
And welcome back to the Phalanx Covenant. But first, there is an important podcast order of business we have to address.
It's true. It was even in our notes for last episode, but we somehow did not hit on it, which is probably just as well since we ran over time.
Yeah, so Jay, when you and Shannon were talking in the episode that you did while I was at New York Comic Con, you talked about a number of important factors, but none more important than your opinions on candy corn.
Which is delicious.
And I know I'm going to court controversy by saying this, but I completely agree. This podcast is unanimous in its love of candy corn. I know a lot of people despise it. That's a valid opinion, but our opinions are our own. Jay, what's your favorite kind of candy corn?
Oh, man. So I like OG candy corn a lot, but my very favorite kind is, you know, the mixed like fall treat bags?
Oh, yeah.
That have the candy corns and like the little pumpkins and the candy corns in a couple different colors. I like the brown version of the candy corn.
Those are really good. I like those a lot, too. But my personal favorites are actually the pumpkins you just mentioned. I think they're kind of the same flavor, but just having them be bigger and rounder means there's more of that satisfying texture that I love so much.
Ultimately, for me, there's a big beggars can't be choosers dimension to it, too, because I've found ever two brands of candy corn, maybe sometimes, that aren't co-processed with peanuts, and their availability is sporadic and limited, so usually it's my favorite is whichever one I can get.
Entirely reasonable. And speaking of entities that probably would assimilate candy corn if they could, the Phalanx. We are in the middle episode of our coverage of the Phalanx Covenant. As we mentioned last time, the Phalanx Covenant is divided into three simultaneous stories: Generation Next, Life Signs, and Final Sanction. And today we're going to be talking about Life Signs.
This is one of those times when I really wish that I were more familiar with at least the movie version of Children of the Corn, because I feel like there are appropriate jokes to be made that I don't know to make.
I mean, you could just make the jokes and hope that they line up. That's what I do with a lot of my jokes.
Go to the phalanx field.
Yes, exactly. Go to the phalanx field, where there are children made of phalanx, and also corn, like candy corn, that they assimilated.
The thing is, I think part of the premise is that, like, the cornfield eats you after you're over a certain age, but I might be mixing it up with Logan's Run, which I've also never seen.
Huh. Now I'm just imagining something like Logan's Fun Run, which is, you know, the thing where they kill you if you're too old, but it's at a carnival and it's lots of fun and there's a cakewalk and also murder.
Logan's Corn Maze?
There we go. I actually went to a corn maze yesterday. It was very nice and very muddy.
Did you get out?
I am actually recording from the middle of the corn maze. It's really a good thing I carry this recording rig with me everywhere I go.
Oh, no. See, I figured I'd be talking to you and it would seem like it was actually you. And towards the end, like, a Miles would claw his way in, like, muddy and scratched up and desperate. And then realize there was, you know, this perfectly ordinary doppelganger who was the one who had actually emerged from the maze.
Oh, man. Maybe they could be a phalanx doppelganger and they could talk with antiquated language or have, like, my outfit but the wrong color.
I don't know. How up are you on the slang that kids use these days?
Not even remotely, he said. Dabbing, possibly.
I think dabbing is yesterday's news. I believe they yeet now.
Oh, yeet. That's kind of hard to say, and that's my only opinion about it.
Fair enough. So, back to the Phalanx and their cornfields.
Right, so let's get a little bit of backstory. What is up with the Phalanx, Jay?
Well, the Phalanx are an increasingly large collective intelligence. It's composed of racist human jerks, well, initially racist human jerks, and then whatever humans they happen to find and absorb, bonded with the techno-organic alien remains of Warlock, deceased New Mutant, and best space teenager.
The initial racist human jerks figured this would make them badass enough to kill all the mutants. Like that thing we mentioned, racist jerks? Yeah, that.
However, their goals shifted as the Phalanx collective intelligence took over to absorbing all of the minds. Mutants remained a threat, but now because they couldn't be as easily absorbed by the Phalanx as humans.
So, meanwhile, elsewhere in the Phalanx Covenant, specifically in Generation Next, which we covered last time, Banshee led a small team in rescuing the next generation of mutants. The Phalanx had kidnapped that next generation to use as sort of test subjects to figure out the whole absorbing mutants part without having to worry about accidentally killing them, because, you know, teenagers. The Phalanx hates teenagers.
They do, what with their loud music and disrespectful slang words.
Yeah, they keep saying yeet all the time.
Not at this point they don't. It's 1994. They probably, I don't know how fake comic book kids talk exactly. Maybe they're all watching Cool as Ice.
I should certainly hope so. The X-Men themselves had already been kidnapped by the Phalanx at this point and replaced by Phalanx duplicates. What's up with the X-Men? We'll get to that next episode.
That's the X-Men, except for a few key members. Scott and Jean, remember, have just gotten back from their honeymoon and haven't met up with the rest of the team yet. Wolverine is off in his own solo book, and, well, Cable isn't one of the X-Men, but he does have his own solo book, and it is eventually going to be part of this crossover. Again, we'll get to that next episode.
As far as the teams that are here, why, it's all the spinoff teams. X-Factor, X-Force, and Excalibur. Jay, do you think you can list all of those teams' members in one breath?
I do. Forge, Havoc, Polaris, Wolfsbane, Strong Guy, Cannonball, Shatterstar, Boomer, Siren, Warpath, Richter, Nightcrawler, Shadowcat, Britannic, Megan, Daytripper, and conditionally, Duglock.
Very nice. Very nice.
Was I supposed to list the teams they were on, too? Because that was just a full roster.
People can figure it out. Unfortunately, in Life Signs, and I feel like a lot of our sentences are going to start with unfortunately in Life Signs, with that gigantic roster to play with, only like 4 or 5 characters are going to be relevant more than very slightly, and that makes me sad.
Much more than the 2 chapters that surround it, this story feels thrown together. For all that the Phalanx Covenant is actually a relatively organized crossover as crossovers go, I was really, really surprised at how disconnected this chapter seemed from itself.
I know. I mean, we're used to Excalibur being pretty iffy in this micro era, but X-Force is usually great, and X-Factor's been awesome as well.
And here, this feels like a story composed of afterthoughts.
Yeah, it's sort of like a microcosm of Excalibur as a whole right now. But I don't want to be too negative, because being too negative is no fun, and there's a lot of really fun stuff, including a giant robot dog in this story. So let's just dive in.
Wait, is it a dog? I thought it might be a dinosaur.
Could be a dogosaur. Let's start with X-Factor number 106, Life Signs, Part 1. Plotted by Scott Lobdell, scripted by Todd DeZago, penciled by Jan Dersima and Roger Cruz, inked by Al Milgram, and colored by Glynis Oliver. And I want to start off talking about this cover, because the cover's done by Steve Lytle, and it's Duglock fighting various members of the various teams, but it's got this beautiful, sketchy, raw style to it that's kind of like a cross between Larry Stroman and Jay Lee, and I am all about this.
One of the things that's really fascinating about this cover is that if you had pulled a lot of pieces out of it and told me that they had been done in 2019, I would absolutely believe you. It's in a style that I think of as much more contemporary to now than to 94.
I completely agree. But one thing that places it firmly in 94, and also places all of these covers firmly in 94, is the gimmickness of it. That's right, front and back are one big image, it's cardstock, there's a technological, reflecty, hologrammy strip across one side, and I'm not gonna lie, I love these covers. I know they're gimmicks, I love them anyway.
Here's the real question. Did you think that the holographic strip was a removable bookmark?
No, this looks much less removable than those trading card things on the cover of Fatal Attractions did. So maybe Marvel learned something.
Man, I wasn't even taken in by those because I wasn't reading comics early enough to be, and I'm still kind of annoyed at those fake trading cards because they look like they should be trading cards.
I tell ya, maybe that's why Executioner's song included trading cards. I don't know. Anyway, we start off in France, specifically at the French monastery from Uncanny X-Men number 300. You remember the one that the Acolytes were hanging out in and kidnapped Moira McTaggart to?
Vaguely. It was never established that firmly as a location besides pastoral and idyllic.
Well, there was this one weird thing about it. Area Monastery has one weird trick for hiding mutants. Like, if there were mutants in it, their signatures weren't detectable from outside. That's mentioned here, and it's still not explained, so whatever. But X-Factor is here.
Whoa. You can't but whatever that away. See, I assumed when I read that that was something that the Acolytes had done or had installed, not something that was inherent to the place. That's fascinating.
It's unclear. Maybe Hickman's gonna set, like, the next era of X-Men instead of in Krakoa, in this monastery.
God, I hope someone has just remembered that and done something deeply weird with it since, or does now.
Maybe. But anyway, X-Factor's here. They magnetically lower themselves down. I guess, like, there aren't any nearby walls to bust through, so they can't X-Factor their way in. But Forge basically says, hey, Xavier had a message for us, and it was urgent and cryptic, and I don't know what it was. But he did say that no technology was allowed, hence the magnetic hovering downward.
However, Xavier notes and Forge notes that Xavier is making one significant exception to this, which is Forge's prosthetic limbs, which is good because adaptive technology should absolutely be an exception to that rule, and I really like that it's just taken for granted that it will be.
That consideration doesn't extend all the way, though, because Shatterstar damn near zaps them out of the sky, because remember, he can occasionally shoot lasers out of his blades when he makes noise? Everybody forgets that.
I assumed that this was one of those signature Charles Xavier, I needed to make you all fight each other to see if you were possessed fights, but it's not. It's just there for no reason.
Well, it's a little bit that, because X-Force and Excalibur, the two teams that are already here, are aware that the Phalanx can impersonate people. So Guido almost punches everybody, Boom Boom almost blows everybody up because Guido and Boom Boom, but eventually they all chill out. And Xavier explains how they got here. That's right, it's time for a flashback.
Now, as you may recall from last episode, the Phalanx replaced most of the X-Men who were in the mansion. It appeared, at least initially, that only Banshee, Jubilee, and Sabretooth were their actual original selves. As it turned out, though, Banshee wasn't the only actual X-Men to come in contact with the Phalanx duplicates. When Kurt was checking in with Beast, or at least who he thought was Beast, he was attacked by a computer screen.
It's actually a really cool image. Like, the computer screen that Nightcrawler is looking at just bulges out into this phalanxy face that turns into a big tendril that explodes outward. I don't know if it's Jan Dersima or Roger Cruz that does this part. Like, Cruz is really aping Dersima's style, which I think is good if you're a second penciler on a regular penciler's book.
I mean, you have to be.
Yeah, but whoever it is, their phalanx is great. It's sort of a mix of Sienkiewicz Warlock and these almost organic roots and muscles and protean masses. They really get the organic part of techno-organic, which I think is super important.
Yeah, that's something I really dig about the way the phalanx is represented throughout the three issues that we're talking about today, really throughout the entire Life Sign story. It feels creepy, alive, and visceral in ways that kind of make it a body horror story. That the other parts don't quite manage, or at least that the Generation Next doesn't, despite the fact that there's more direct phalanx invasion of bodies there than there is in this one.
Agreed, yeah. So Excalibur, realizing that the phalanx has completely overrun Muir Isle, escape, and just as they think they're clear in their hovercraft, Xavier's wheelchair, you know, like that yellow, very techie one from this era, from the 90s cartoon, all of a sudden it morphs into a big phalanx and starts attacking everyone. And that is a good, creepy use of the phalanx. The idea that in any technology whatsoever, that could be phalanx. Any people around you, they could be the phalanx. There's no escape from the phalanx. You don't know when they're there. That's part of why they're such effective villains, I think.
This is going to be something that years later, Joss Whedon is going to play on to write Danger when she first comes to life.
Totally, yeah, and that's a good parallel. So Excalibur just blows up the ship, and they end up floating and magicking over to the aforementioned monastery, since it hides mutant signatures, and that brings us up to the present.
Hey, ain't no party like a monastery party, because a monastery party don't stop until a phalanx build a giant tower and attempt to take over the world.
Right, which hasn't happened quite yet, so there we go. So Xavier explains what's going on. He's like, hey, there are these other two teams and the other comics, and you guys should probably buy them because Marvel needs more money because the speculator boom is kind of wrecking the company. But as for our own mission, well, we have something else we need to do. We need to take down the Phalanx themselves.
And that means figuring out what they're up to. And to that end, well, we've got something that might be a secret weapon, but we'll hold that off for more exposition. Now, remember, X-Force is here, and X-Force loves to jump half-cocked into battles. This is no exception. Shatterstar is furious that they are off hiding instead of fighting a literally unbeatable enemy.
And I really appreciate here, with X-Force and X-Factor in the same room, that we get to see Cannonball take over Havoc's usual role of embarrassed team leader.
Havoc is here, though. Why is Havoc here? Didn't he quit?
No, I think he rejoined the team after his shitty Hawaiian vacation got ruined by Malice and the Nasty Boys.
You'd think that would be all the more reason not to be on the team.
It's Alex Summers. Like, the worse his life gets because of the X-Men, the more he gets drawn into the X-Men.
He does spend a fair chunk of this story wishing that he were just a human on Earth, sleeping, unaware of their impending death.
I feel like Alex Summers spends a fair portion of his life that way. Cannonball decides to get far away from Shatterstar and goes to find his old friend Wolfsbane. Because remember, Sam and Rain were on a team together, like, forever. They were super, super tight, and they don't see each other much these days.
But Wolfsbane is busy trying to get past Megan in order to see someone who may or may not be another old teammate of theirs, and that is Duglock. So let's take a second to talk about Duglock and what his deal is.
So Duglock, as we understand him now in 1994, what we're covering, was a Phalanx recreation of Doug Ramsey using genetic material and techno-organic material from Warlock. So he's not Doug, he's not Warlock, but he looks like Doug, and he seems to have little bits and pieces of Doug's personality, maybe.
He's partially made from Doug's engrams or from some vague impression of Doug's mind. That much is clear at this point, and that much is at least nominally confirmed in this story. Now, what we'll find out much later is that, in fact, this is just Warlock with a faint impression of Doug's mind. And until very, very recently, he was part of the Phalanx's hive consciousness until he was lured away and sort of forcibly split from it by Zero, who is a robot from the future who is now dead, and that's mostly irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Wolfsbane is really, really happy to have him there.
Seems like every time we turn around lately, we're losing one of our friends, our family. But herein, God's decided that we can have Doug back. And I just can't wait any longer to see him.
And there he is, and he has restrained himself to the wall. He has anchored himself into it with his own sort of spreading techno-organic flesh, which, yeah, that's a questionable method of restraint.
I don't know. Phalanx programming something something. But Rain is ecstatic. She knows this has got to be Doug. And Cannonball, who shows up to meet her, no, he's angry and he's bitter. Because this is clearly a fraud, taking his friend's face, making a mockery of his friend's death. What they remind me of is the two halves of Shadowcat, because she's had both of those reactions to Duglock, as we've seen in Excalibur.
But there's someone else who's going to react very, very differently.
And that's Forge, who shows up to see what's going on. And his mouth just hangs open as we see beams of multicolored light radiating out from Duglock, passing through everybody else and obscuring the background of the two-page spread. It's simple, but it's beautiful. What I like about that, as we learn that Forge is seeing the Phalanx as only he can because of his powers that just understand the fundamental rules that underlie technology and really the universe, we get the impression that what Forge is seeing, we can't. We're just seeing, like, yeah, a two-dimensional image of this 12-dimensional view of the Phalanx that Forge sees. And what sells it, I think, is Dersima, or possibly Cruz's, version of Forge's face, there's just this look of awe and shock and utter unpreparedness.
We're going to see a few artists attempt this particular point of view over the course of the story, and I think this is where it's done best. I still found this one a little lacking, but I agree that it's the strongest of the set.
So Doug Locke helpfully explains the phalanx to everybody. We should get him a guest spot on our show.
A lot of this story is spent with people explaining things at length to one another. It's a very, very exposition-heavy crossover. I get the impression that that's deliberate and is sort of so you don't have to pick up every book, but honestly, the cost of reading all of that exposition is high.
Well, at least it's really cool-looking because all of the panels that house the explanatory dialogue are sort of in these gaps and bubbles within Doug's techno-organic mesh as he expands himself to cover the room, so that's cool.
Well, it's visually cool when Doug Locke's the one doing the exposition, but he's hardly the only one over the course of this.
So what's the deal with the phalanx? Well, this is the deal with the phalanx. So Genosha, you know, the old mutant apartheid metaphor country that sucked a whole lot, they went broke after the extinction agenda because their whole government was awful and fell, and so they sold Warlock's remains to some unnamed evil scientists who then themselves tried to use that techno-organic technology to make new living sentinels to be shitty to mutants.
Now, we saw at least part of what happened to Warlock's remains. They were spread on Doug's grave, but clearly either Genosha went and dug them up or the New Mutants weren't able to scoop up quite everything. Either way, there's, you know, plenty of feasible explanations for this.
There's lots of Warlock dust to go around. Oh, that's dark.
Aw.
The nascent Phalanx decided that they needed a hive mind because hive minds are awesome and very powerful, but they would need to channel that through somebody who already had a sort of interface with machinery. And they figured, hey, what about Stephen Lang? What about that guy from Project Armageddon who was a big proponent of Sentinels and opponent of mutants? I mean, on the one hand, yes, his mind has been utterly shattered, but there was that one time he merged with Master Mold, so he'd probably be fine. And anyway, whoever we chose, it would shatter their mind anyway, so this just saves us a step.
Wow. I never thought I'd feel bad for Stephen Lang, but I feel kind of bad for Stephen Lang.
Yeah, right? So the Phalanx went through a bunch of different stages. There were the early prototypes that were really weak and made mostly of pink goo that fought Bishop and Rogue a long time ago. There were later versions based on corpses of the X-Men's friends and allies that decayed when they were damaged. Those were the ones that posed as Candy Southern and Cameron Hodge and attacked Archangel. After that, the Phalanx tried converting humans, figuring that might make them a little tougher, and those were the Phalanx who attacked Storm, Yukio, and Gambit. It works pretty well, but this is where the Phalanx found out that they could absorb humans, but they couldn't absorb mutants. I actually really like how all of these different faces of Phalanx, that's just an explanation essentially for different artistic styles. It's a visual retcon saying, no, 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 we know they didn't look the same from one appearance to the next, but there was a reason for that, and that's really clever.
I love that. I love, in general, and I've said this before, I will say it again, likewise that explanatory phrase, but I feel like comics work best when medium and story are working as one, are mutually aware, are more a synthesis than a combination. And I think this is a great example of that.
Totally.
Even if it's retroactive.
But the next stage in Phalanx evolution is that their original Technarch programming, you know, the programming from Warlock's jerk species who are all jerks except for Warlock, yeah, that's taking over because it's built right into the techno-organic stuff of them. So now, what was once merely an anti-mutant organization of transcendent cybernetic beings now just wants to destroy and absorb all organic life on the planet. So, yeah, they're a lot more dangerous than we thought before.
And I'll note, this is the story that the Warlock episode of the X-Men cartoon is most directly based on.
Yeah, the one where he has a wife and it's kind of weird, but it's still a pretty cool episode.
That part's strange, though.
We'll find out only a couple years after this that there's more to the Phalanx. There are the pure Phalanx. We'll get to that later. It doesn't really matter here. I actually really like that we only find out this one little corner of the Phalanx for now. And of course, in modern X-Men, well, there's more going on there too.
As is not always the case in X-Men, though, the ways in which it gets more complicated are often pretty interesting and pretty organic.
Techno-organic.
Hey, I see what you did there.
So, Doug Locke figures, I've told my story, now I need to do something about it. And he's just met Forge, a person who can see the phalanx in a way that nobody else can, so he nabs him and techno-organically merges with him and goes off to take down the phalanx. Wolfsbane and Cannonball are like, whoa, what are you doing? And Doug says, can't explain, gotta go. Rain trusts Doug Locke and voluntarily comes along. Cannonball not so much, so he knocks Cannonball out, and the four of them just X-Factor their way out through the confused and gathered Excalibur, X-Factor, and X-Force.
And while Doug Locke may not have Doug Ramsey's memories, he does recognize the value of a good misunderstanding fight, so he doesn't bother explaining what's up on his way out.
And all he says as he leaves is,
Babel awaits, and Babel must be stopped.
What also awaits is a named character with a little backstory we get. This is Giuseppe Russo, and as the narration tells us,
he has been a shepherd for almost all of his 68 years. He enjoys the solitude of his pastoral vocation. His entire life has been devoted to the task of tending the flock.
A name and a backstory revealed so quickly? You know what that means, or you might know what that means, maybe in a general sense. In a specific sense, you might be surprised.
That's right, a giant red techno-organ... Wait, is this Grimlock?
No. This gigantic red techno-organic dog man in a blue cape is Shinar. He's a phalanx who absorbed a dog for some reason, and I guess he's also red, and I guess he also likes capes. And here he is. He will be our villain for this story, and I kind of love him because I don't understand him at all.
Okay, first of all, he really looks like a dinosaur.
Dino dog. Dogasaur.
That's not...
It's totally a thing.
Yeah, whatever. And second... Okay.
So, yeah, Giuseppe's toast, whatever. But Shinar's here, and, you know, I gotta say I'm a little disappointed. I like how bonkers the concept is, but I wish he did more dog-like things. I mean, the phalanx are scary, yeah, but would they be scarier if they also sniffed your butt before they attacked you? Would they be scarier if they just tried to pee on random things? I'm just saying.
They'd definitely be more unpleasant.
Well, there you go. Unpleasantness is scary.
I mean... But you're reducing dogs to these really basic behaviors. What if the phalanx were really eager to please?
I think they are. It's just that they're eager to please, like, the technarch race of organic-destroying aliens that they serve.
I mean, I guess they kind of love you no matter what in a really predatory way.
So it kind of works. Stephen Lang, who is in touch with all of the Phalanx because Hive Mind, he's watching this whole thing from Phalanx HQ, and he's concerned because Shinar is kind of blocked off from the collective robot consciousness.
Is it because he ate a dog?
I mean, maybe. Lang also seems to really disapprove of that. I don't know if it's just a taboo or if he just thinks it's gross or what.
I think Lang's got a lot of issues.
Probably. And another one is that Cameron Hodge, when Lang asks Hodge what the hell is going on, just sort of says meh and pieces out without being dismissed. What is going on with this collective intelligence? What's the point of having a hive mind if everyone just does their own goddamn thing? There are rules for a reason, people.
Okay. Now, I'm going to go ahead and say that everyone should know better than to try to team up with Cameron Hodge. He gives no fucks. It's like teaming up with Mr. Sinister.
It's not going to work out. It might be a little fun in an evil way, but it's not going to work out.
Like, your interests will line up until he sees something more entertaining, and then you're done.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dive from there to X-Force number 38, The Faith Dancers.
This is written by Fabian Nicieza, penciled by Tony Daniel, inked by Kevin Conrad, colored by Marie Javins. And I know that I rag on Tony Daniel a lot in this era, but... Damn it.
I really like his take on a bunch of different characters, but what he really likes appears to be teenagers' butts.
Nope. I mean, yeah, but also nope.
Wolfsbane, I mean, her uniform is, it's like a one-piece bathing suit, and the thong problem is a problem in the 90s in general. But goddamn, it's so thongy. And like, okay, I'm a pretty furry dude. I'm not as furry as Rain, but even I wouldn't want to wear something like that. There'd be so much butt hair pulling. It must be so uncomfortable for her.
Well, that definitely took a turn.
I'm just concerned for the comfort of my friends.
Valid. And there's also some stuff later that really annoys me, because there are a bunch of places where I feel like the narration has to compensate for things that the art doesn't quite manage to do. And that's not how comics should work.
Well, we'll get to that, and part of where we'll get to it is in an idyllic village in the Italian Alps, which has a bunch of signs on their storefronts that are all in English. I don't know, I guess a lot of the world is multilingual.
So, I fully recognize that I don't know when The Big Lebowski came out, but I don't think that the TV edit of it, at least, was out yet at this point. But I'm still kind of disappointed that no one at any point during a fight in this episode yelled, "That's what you get when you meet a stranger in the Alps."
Listeners, if you're not familiar with that line, Google it. It's great.
It's originally something else.
So Cannonball really doesn't like this whole thing about being captured and taken to the Alps. He also doesn't like Duglock.
Yeah, and because this is the Phalanx Covenant and there's a lot of exposition, even Sam's angry rant is pretty expository.
And then you decide it's as good a time as any to wrap yourself all over Forge like wet fur on a hound dog, bonding with him in your own special phalanx way, leaving him two oars shy of rowing the boat. I object to this. That is clearly Mississippi Southern metaphor, not Kentucky Southern metaphor. Rogue would like a word, Guthrie.
Also, the wet fur on a hound dog metaphor isn't a real good one in this context, because presumably the wet fur was on the hound dog to begin with and is just clingier when wet, not, you know, attacking the hound dog from outside and wrapping itself around the hound dog. Maybe like, I don't know, what over-enthusiastic toddlers on a hound dog.
All I know is that a hound dog that furry should not wear a thong. So Rain is like, dude, our friend is back. Have you become so just like blind to miracles because you're working with a guy like Cable all the time? And they have this really effective heart to heart. And Sam admits to his old friend, you know, I think I'm just afraid of caring about this person who I lost once in case I lose him again. Something that crossovers have the opportunity to do, and sometimes they do them and sometimes they don't, is this. It's taking all of the history between characters who maybe have been apart for a long time and just bringing it back, bringing those dynamics right back. And that's so satisfying to see.
Yeah, I am really glad that Nicieza was writing this issue, because, again, I feel like of the current folks, he's the one whose roots are most firmly in the original New Mutants and in that dynamic.
So, conversation had, they head into town. They meet a stranger in the Alps. So in this town, everybody looks normal. It's very idyllic. Everyone's smiling. But we go from one panel where that's the case to the next panel where all of the people in the town are in the same position with the same expressions, but they're all made of phalanx techno-organic stuff. It's actually pretty cool and creepy.
It is. This is the Duglock's eye view, but it's also the Forge's eye view, because having briefly merged with Duglock, Forge, in addition to his Forgeo vision, can now kind of see the phalanx, can see how it works.
And there's this cool image that the narration describes very well, where we just see everything, you know, as part of one gigantic interconnected system of like life and inorganic material and math and perfection. And that sounds awesome, but the way it's drawn is just that all the people and some of the objects are black silhouettes with like stars in the background. And to me, that just seems like such a missed opportunity. Forge's powers, him getting this ability, it should be awe-inspiring. We should understand why Forge is so blown away and why he's becoming increasingly sympathetic with the phalanx. The art needs to sell that, and I don't think it does here. And I was trying to think of what artist that could work better with, and I don't know, maybe like Alan Davis or Kent Williams. Or, I don't know. What do you think, Jay?
Okay. First of all, I absolutely agree. This is the spot, in fact, that I was talking about where the captions are doing the heavy lifting because the art just absolutely fails to do what it sets out to do. In terms of what artists could do it, I actually have two answers, and I think they'd both be brilliant. First of all, I feel like for something like this, you want to go for the big guns. And you're talking about a couple artists who are very good, but who don't really specialize in this particular type of weirdness. So I would absolutely first go to Barry Smith.
Oh, Barry Windsor Smith. That's a great choice. Like the way he used to do all that Weapon X-y stuff, all that tech and organics merged together. That would be great.
Well, in the way he's able to humanize it and the ways he uses texture. So he's the obvious choice. A contemporary to us one who I don't think was drawing comics at this time is Felipe Andrade.
Yeah, I could totally see that too.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't immediately place that name, that's the guy who drew the What If Magic one-shot that Leo Williams wrote, which had much cooler and I think much more mathematical and structured versions of magic without a K than we generally see in comics.
So it's at this point that Professor Xavier telepathically Skypes in to check on Forge, and they start debating, so what do we do about the Phalanx? Forge says, hey, they're sentient, they're this new species, they're beautiful, I know they're very problematic, they're trying to kill everyone, but we can't just kill them, and Xavier's concerned, because Forge has taken the Phalanx, is changing moment by moment.
Now, this raises a question. Whether Forge's position is a result of some sort of corruption from merging with Duglock, or whether it's just a byproduct of his own mindset. Because on one hand, it's a strong stance to take, but on the other hand, it's a very, very Forge stance to take.
Yeah, I mean, when you see everything as this one beautiful system and each of that system's components as being uniquely beautiful as well, like, it kind of makes sense. And we see more of that system as our party of four plus telepathic hanger-on looks over a cliff onto the nursery conduit, which looks fucking awesome. This is something that Tony Daniel does really, really well. It's like this massive StarCraft Zerg-like organic mountain of membranes and techno-organic veins and buttresses and roots and branches with this sort of techno-organic blossom at the top. It is one of the coolest Phalanx images in this entire story.
You mind if I completely ruin the ambiance you just developed with that description?
Oh, my ambiance. Okay.
Well, so I was looking at the outline, and I'm sort of reading it out of the corner of my eye as we record, and because of the wrap and the way I have the window, I first read it as being an organic mountain of membranes and TO veins and butts.
Butts instead of buttresses? I mean, butts are organic, I guess, unless you use pesticides with them?
I don't know, but I'm just really entertained by that idea.
Well, anyway, buttresses and butts kind of aside, what this is, as Duglock expositions, is a cluster of Phalanx pods. These are basically Phalanx eggs. These are new Phalanx that are being created that don't have hosts yet. It actually kind of reminds me of the nursery in Steven Universe in a weird way.
Wait, so did the Phalanx build eggs or did they lay them?
I'm going to say they lay them because it's funnier.
Valid.
So the Phalanx have sentient thought. We've seen that in Duglock. They can reproduce. Forge and Xavier are continuing to talk, and it's pretty clear to both of them, yeah, the Phalanx are a real species. And Xavier actually telepathically asks Cannonball if Cannonball still reads science fiction novels like he used to. And Sam's like, nah, there's no time these days. Xavier responds,
as it has always been. But you should always try to find the time to read, Sam. To experience the wonder of imagination.
A reading rainbow.
Yes, sir. I know. Again, this is why I love crossovers. All these old dynamics coming back. It's delightful. Forge checks out one of these freshly from a phalanx's butt lane eggs, and it bursts open with a giant techno-organic tendril to try to absorb him. And oh, the narration.
Xavier hears, he sees, and worse, he knows. The Phalanx will breed. The offspring will continue to assimilate all life forms. The Covenant will be spread to other worlds as it had been brought to this one. There will be change. They will bring a clean, clinical order to the very fabric and structure of all reality. Inexorably, inevitably, one cell at a time, if need be.
That is fucking chilling.
Not to Forge, it's not. Forge is into it.
Yeah, whether it's a techno-organic exposure or his powers, like we were saying, he thinks this is kind of beautiful. But this narration works, and I think Nicieza is doing his best to take a story that doesn't fully work and to just make as many elements of it work as possible.
Meanwhile, back in France, which I get to say entirely relevantly now, which is a rare event. Meanwhile, back in France, Xavier reports to the assembled teams that, well, Banshee's team and Cyclops' team are doing their own things and they're doing well, but they think the Phalanx are just a threat to mutants, which means it's up to this ragtag band of heroes to save the Earth.
So they split the combined teams into two. The more powerful team is going to stay here in France to protect Moira as she researches Phalanx stuff, and the sneakier team is going to go off to Switzerland to meet up with Duglock and help him defeat the Phalanx.
Well, assuming that Duglock wants to or can, they're still a little unsure of his motives.
But Duglock does have a plan. He's going to techno-organically infect Cannonball and Wolfsbane, and of course he's already done so to Forge, so that they can all stealth into the Phalanx's base, the aforementioned Babel Spire. And this is weird, because Duglock is kind of cavalier about this, and yeah, Sam and Rain are a little scared, but it's not presented as that big of a deal. But back in the day when Warlock used to merge with Doug, it was like this terrifying threat and this beautiful intimacy every time, and now it's just sort of, meh, this is what we need to do right now. Is it just the stakes being raised? Is it power creep? I don't know.
There are a couple options I can see here. One is that previous context is supposed to make us see it as a bigger deal than it's presented as here. Like, that's supposed to give us the context that this comic doesn't. The other possibility, and the more plausible one, I think, is that when Warlock and Doug were merging, they really didn't know what they were doing or about the potential outcomes of it. This is a Duglock who is aware of all of the layers of Phalanx research that have happened since, including the fact that it can't effectively bond with mutants.
That's actually a very good point. And the Phalanx is not the same as Warlock, so it does have slightly different mechanics. So, yeah, fair enough. Well, it works. Just like the zombie impersonations in Shaun of the Dead, they do manage to sneak through all the Phalanx, but it's too late because the Babel Spire bursts out of the ground, this rocky, mechanical, techno-organic tendril full of wires and windows and towers and pods, and again, it looks awesome. Daniel does this stuff so well. And we learn from Doug what's going to happen with all this.
So, the purpose of the Babel Tower, the Babel Spire, is to signal the Technarch, to tell them the Phalanx is ready and wants to merge with them, and that the Earth is ready to be consumed and to become part of the Interplanetary Phalanx Network.
Yeah, or the Interplanetary Technarch Network. And remember, the Technarch, that's like Warlock's dad, Magus. That's the techno-organic entities that do this sort of thing. They're just terrifying, these enormous monsters throughout the galaxy. So this is even worse than we thought things were before. It's a legit, terrifying, solid premise, which is why the fact that Life Signs is just sort of slow and boring is that much more sad.
Here's the other thing that got me about that. The last time we saw the techno-organic virus present a really, really imminent, really substantial threat was when it took over Limbo. And one of the things that the representations of the Babel Spire do incredibly effectively is evoke the imagery of Inferno. And I was really hoping that we'd get more callback to that, that we'd get at least some reference, and it's just not there.
Yeah, or maybe like the comic could cut out to space, to the technarchy doing scary stuff, and that would add a sense of stakes, but what can you do?
That brings us to the final issue of Life Signs. Thankfully, The Light of a Tainted Dawn, this is Excalibur number 82, plotted by Scott Lobdell, scripted by Todd DeZago, penciled by Ken Lashley and Stephen Epting, inked by Philip Moy, Harry Candelario, W.C. Karani, John Floyd, and John Livesay, colored by Chris Mathis.
Two pencilers and five inkers? Well, that seems like a good sign to me. On the upside, Lashley and Epting's Babel Spire does look fucking scary because they put in what it's made of, which is a bunch of screaming faces. It's made of people, and they're very sad.
I'd say probably more horrified than sad.
You could be both.
Read the Spire, man. As it turns out, Douglock's flash of intuition that this was up, that he needed to go stop it, was actually a trap set by the Phalanx. They wanted him to come back, and they wanted him to bring Forge, whom they recognized as a possible ally and or tool. Which makes sense, because Forge is kind of a tool.
And the person who explains all this is everybody's favorite dog man himself, who was just rolling around in something dead, so he smells probably pretty gross. That dead thing was that Giuseppe guy, I assume. He says he wants Forge to be the midwife to the birth of this new life form, and he's pretty fucking...
No, he doesn't. He says that he wants Forge to be the mind wife, in scare quotes, to the birth of the new life form.
Is that deliberate or a typo? I like it either way.
I think it's deliberate.
Well, that's pretty cool. Douglock, though, has a plan.
And Douglock's plan is to turn heel, to say, yeah, I knew it all along. I came back to join back up. I brought you Forge. I brought you these other mutants. Rah, rah, go Phalanx. It is... He doesn't sell it well. Like, he's really obviously lying. And Shannara also recognizes and immediately calls this out and is like, yeah, we're just going to throw everyone but Forge in the Babel Spire.
So that's no good, but thankfully we have a whole bunch of other characters that we've barely touched, and they're getting restless back at the monastery, especially X-Force.
Shatterstar and Thunderbird are very upset because they didn't get to go along on the rescue effort, which Havoc explains is because it's a stealth mission and they yell all the time.
It's easy to forget that Havoc is very much a grown-up compared to the X-Force people, because, like, Shatterstar comes off as an adult. Warpath basically does. I think that's just a problem with superhero book art, is that, like, if you're anywhere between about 19 years old and about 40 years old, you kind of look the same.
When you say very much an adult as compared to, I mean, I think you're talking about the difference between, like, 23 and 19.
Yeah, I guess so. But the point is, Havoc is mature, and he intimidates them, and they back down. Meanwhile, though, in the floating metal sphere that the stealth team is heading to Switzerland in, Boom Boom and Shadowcat have a conversation.
Kit Kat, I mean, are you gonna be okay?
Tabitha, the way my life has been going lately, I don't know if I'm ever gonna be okay again. After losing Ilyana, losing Rachel, my father has mysteriously disappeared, and now Doug has miraculously returned from the dead and is merrily leading us straight into the end of the world as we know it. I don't know. Okay seems so far away.
Hey, it's all relative, you know? Like, sometimes things just get really crazed and you just can't take it anymore, and then just when you think it can't get any worse, it does! So then you think, you know, the first part wasn't really that bad.
Boomer, is there a point here?
Well, okay is what you make it.
These are two characters we haven't seen interact much, and I kind of dig them together.
I do too. I feel like they would make kind of a hellaciously wonderful team.
That would be pretty great. I'm sure they've teamed up at some point. There's been a lot of X-Men. But anyway... So the stealth team has got to Switzerland, there are a whole lot of Phalanx, and Kurt has a strategy.
Man, this is the stealth team, you know? So not only is Boomer on the stealth team, but we've also got, you know, Richter and Siren, and specifically they're being propelled by, Polaris has made a big magnetic bubble, and she's basically lifting them by the scruffs of their blood, and... It's being propelled along by Siren screaming nonstop, which might be the least stealthy form of propulsion available to them.
Maybe she's whisper screaming, just like, like, you know, when Bella tries to meow, but she can't quite get the air out and she just sort of goes, and there's no sound.
Yeah, but she also makes really great, horrible croaking noises, which are also not stealthy.
Well, maybe Siren's doing that. Anyway, Nightcrawler has a strategy.
That's right. He has decided that the way to take out the Phalanx is by embracing chaos.
Everything the Phalanx does is contingent on logic. They don't make a move unless it's based on some good solid reasoning, and probably checked and double-checked at the Phalanx head office, their collective intelligence. Any action on their part is logical and rational, and they expect the same from us. The only way, then, to defeat the Phalanx is to do the unexpected, the illogical, and just keep them guessing.
Wait a minute. And this is his plan, and he decided not to bring Shatterstar along for this? This is like, if you want to throw an enemy into chaos, you just kind of pitch Shatterstar at them. That is the ideal means to this goal.
Also, they left the strength team at home, and they brought the stealth team, and now the stealth team's strategy is just to punch everyone? Whatever. This is life signs.
The screaming stealth team.
The screaming stealth team. So, Shinar has taken Forge to check out the eggs.
Yeah, this is a very, very alien, the original movie Alien looking setup here. We've got a bunch of half buried, semi translucent eggs that are definitely full of things that are kind of come and attach themselves to your face and grow in your chest.
Forge's job here is to ensure that all the phalanx eggs get a constant power source, that it doesn't fluctuate even when the spire's power goes up and down. Forge has the ideal ways of perceiving the phalanx and also coming up with the tech to make this happen. That's why he was drawn here.
Forge is having some complicated feelings about this. He knows he's being manipulated, but he can't resist. It's not exactly that the phalanx, you know, are actually controlling him so much as that they have figured out the perfect way to take advantage of his powers. They've figured out his weak point, which is cool stuff.
Basically. And I'm a little sad that the gigantic team of artists does not draw what Tony Daniel did, which is little bits of techno-organic stuff starting to cover Forge's skin. I think that could be an important visual reminder of the ambiguity of this whole thing.
Now, Forge is unable to shake off this compulsion until a screaming stealth team shows up, or at least Nightcrawler does, and gives him a hell of a pep talk, and Forge is able to just sort of feel real hard and break out of it.
Hooray! And so as that happens, Duglock climbs up to rescue Cannonball and Wolfsbane from the big mass of squishy techno-organic people juice.
And to help them break out, because remember, mutants can't be absorbed easily into the phalanx, so they can basically just sort of wriggle their way out, and now they have to destroy the beacon using teamwork.
Hooray! Doug initially figures they'll just all merge into one big being and he'll use all their power, and Sam's like, no, dude, that's not how we do things. So we get a little bit of Doug character development here. He's becoming more and more of an individual, less and less of what the phalanx built him to be.
We also get some really great scenes of Rain kind of bridging the gulf between Sam and Doug, because she very explicitly recognizes that this is not Doug Ramsey, but she sees it as something that's remarkable enough and has enough of Doug to it to still matter and to still be worth fighting for and protecting and befriending.
Rain is the best. I mean, a lot of people are the best, but Rain is certainly among the best.
She's a good kid. Now, unfortunately for them, the tower is finished, and it has already started to transmit its signal. But, says Duglock, they can actually jam it, and all it'll take is the sacrifice of a single life force. Hey, it's a bargain.
That's one of those things that doesn't necessarily make sense and isn't necessarily adequately explained, but that's just sort of how plots work, so sure, let's go with it.
So, I don't think that Doug is saying it's going to take any life force. He's saying, yes, and the cost of it is just going to be a single life force, and he means himself and isn't expecting Sam to do what he does next.
Which is to volunteer, because Sam blames himself for Doug's death back in the day. He was the team leader. But dude, Sam, you were the team co-leader. It's half Mirage's fault too. Doug doesn't buy it.
Sam, while I am not Doug Ramsey, as much as everyone, it seems, would like me to be, I do have a limited access to his memories. I know how he felt about you. I know he would never blame you for his death. Just as I know he would never ask you to do something that is his place to do.
And Duglock throws himself into the beacon, and it interrupts the signal, and everything is okay. And Doug's okay too, actually. He survived, he says, because unlike the phalanx, he still had something to live for outside of that collective.
Hey, I assume that it was also because he wasn't linked to the phalanx hive mind when it melted down.
That too. But I have a question here. So all they had to do to blow up the entire Babel Spire was just to interrupt the signal? That's like unplugging a computer's Ethernet cable and having it detonate. I don't think that works. It's never happened that way with me.
Okay, remember the second Spider-Man movie, the second Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie?
Oh yeah, it was great.
With Dr. Octopus?
He was great.
Okay, remember the device that was part of his arms that kept them from going evil and taking over his mind?
Yes, every computer has one of those.
Right, so this what the Spire has, that the power source is connected through, is a box of not exploding.
Oh, there was a bug in the not exploding module. That makes sense.
Exactly, yeah.
So, yeah, that's life signs. It's a great premise that doesn't really take advantage of it, but does remain a great premise and does have a lot of really cool bits and pieces.
Also really cool are our listeners, and you have questions.
Derek L. Chase asks on Twitter, what are the most important Hope Summers stories?
Oh, you are singing my song, Derek L. Chase. Hope is a really neat character. She's weird. She gets used as a MacGuffin a lot. And part of her use as a MacGuffin ends up becoming, in again, a really good piece of retroactive continuity and retroactive fleshing out of continuity, context for some very good character development. So while she technically makes her debut in Messiah Complex, she is in that story 100% a MacGuffin.
Also a baby.
A baby MacGuffin. Now, from there, you're going to want to jump to Cable Volume 2, Number 6. You'll keep going until you get to the next crossover, and that's Second Coming, which leads directly into The Five Lights, which in turn will take you to the miniseries Generation Hope. Now, Avengers vs. X-Men is technically an important Hope story, but again, she basically reverts back to MacGuffin form after being a really interesting character in her own right, so personally, I would skip ahead to X-Force Volume 4 from there.
That is a criminally underrated series. That's the one by Cy Spurrier. The characters are a little off voice-wise, but that's kind of what you get in a Cy Spurrier book. He writes the characters the way he writes them. He's got an amazing vision and amazing concepts, and it holds together beautifully.
And Hope has shown up on and off since then, most recently shooting Cyclops in the face. But honestly, I feel like that's the last place we saw her undergo sort of a really significant transformation. And if you want, you know, just sort of the what she's been up to since, the answer is becoming the leader of the Brotherhood and shooting Cyclops in the face.
The MLF, I believe.
Yeah, the MLF. Sorry. I occasionally mix up my angry mutant groups.
Legit.
Goblin Pryor asks on Tumblr, just listen to the episode where you explained blood ties and Max mentions Sarah Gray at the end. Do you have an explanation about Paul Bailey, her husband? He disappeared when she did in X Factor number 12, but while she was killed by the Phalanx and Joey and Galen died in End of Grays, I don't recall Paul ever being mentioned.
Good point, Goblin Pryor. So Sarah Gray is, of course, Jean Grey's sister. Atuma tried to turn her into an Atlantean once. It was real weird. But yeah, she had a husband named Paul, and he showed up like once ever. And what we learned was, I don't know, he hangs out with his wife and has a good mustache. Now, he technically does appear one more time in X-Men Forever, Volume 1, Number 3, but that's an alternate timeline, so I don't think it counts. His only on-page appearance was back at Jean/Phoenix's funeral after the Dark Phoenix saga. So he wasn't around for their house being bombed, for the kids being kidnapped and brainwashed by Nanny, any of this stuff, or, like you mentioned, End of Grays, which, well, that's probably for the best. That didn't work out for any of the Grays. So here's my theory. Paul Bailey rode away to heaven on his pretty damn good mustache, just like the raccoon dog Tanuki Elder rode away to heaven by turning his scrotum into a golden ship in Studio Ghibli's classic film Pompoko.
Wow, I was going to refer to Beards Going Nowhere. That's much less dubious.
It's Pompoko. Have you seen that movie, listeners? You should. It's really great. Jonathan Taylor Thomas plays a raccoon dog whose scrotum is also very important to the plot. And somehow Disney decided to release this. I suspect they got Ghibli's catalog and the deal was that they had to release everything. And so they're like, fuck, how do we turn a movie about raccoon balls into something children can watch in America? And they did their best.
Tanuki aren't exactly raccoons.
I mean, they're kind of close. Anyway, it's actually a really good movie, legitimately, but real weird and lots of balls.
Lots of balls.
We're a fully listener-supported podcast, perhaps sometimes against those listeners' better judgment, and certain levels of support come with on-air acknowledgement from various fictional characters and concepts. Angry Claremontian narrator, save us!
You're asking the wrong narrator, my friend. Your choices lie before you, Sean Ashley, as a road split in twain. On one side, your world, your family, your friends, everything you've come to value in your too brief time on this earth. On the other, unlimited potential, power unstemmed. You know how this story goes, Sean. You saw Sin-Nefer face the same choice and be consumed by it. Why do you never learn? And the Meg from here goes to Shinar, who seems to have survived the fall of the Phalanx.
Just a moment. I need to finish techno-organically urinating on this carbon-based plant life form. There we are. Now it shall be marked as belonging to the Phalanx, as all matter on this doomed world belongs to us. When the Technarchy arrives, it too shall be assimilated, thanks to my pee. Huh, I detect new scents. Ah, Grant Raycroft and Jono. Unit Designate Duglock has done well in bringing you here, for you are uniquely suited to serving your techno-organic conquerors. Grant Raycroft, you have been selected to watch over this litter of Phalanx puppies. They represent the next generation of our species, and are techno-adorable. You must scritch their circuitry and take them for techno-woxies, though they spell your species' doom. But look into those eyes. Can you resist? You cannot resist! And Jono, your task is just as necessary. You have been selected for your mutant strength to hurl this thin wooden column to the other side of the Phalanx kennel, at which point I shall test my techno-organic speed and agility by retrieving it and returning it to you again. We shall repeat this exercise that I may train my cybernetic flesh to its peak efficiency. Oh, and one more thing. As you do so, you must cry out, "Fetch, Shinar!" Do not ask why. It is the will of the Phalanx! It is necessary. It is your feeble species' dark fate. Who is a good boy? Shinar is a good boy!
And with that,
Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is recorded in Forest Hills, New York and Portland, Oregon, and produced by Matt Hunter.
New episodes come out Sundays on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and at explainthexmen.com.
Check out explainthexmen.com for all kinds of extra content, including visual companions to every episode.
Our show is 100% listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air and ad-free, check out the Patreon link at the top of explainthexmen.com.
Next week, the X-Lines solo titles team up
for the final chapter of the Phalanx Covenant.
I wish we could just end the episode there, because that's a really good end beat.